It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris with a quick production note. This episode will be our last as a weekly program. The Confluence is expanding to a daily schedule, broadcasting live from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern on 90.5 WESA or wherever you get your podcasts. That starts Monday, August 27th, 2018. We hope you'll join us then. Back to the show.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Will the Supreme Court's ruling in the Janus case weaken public sector unions in Pennsylvania, their influence, and as a result, workers' pay? Is nature turning on us with an increase in potentially deadly ticks, cases of rabies, and invasive species? And we'll talk with the new editor about the direction of Pittsburgh City Paper. But first,
President Trump has made his choice to fill a second seat on the U.S. Supreme Court.
He's young. He's only 53 years old.
It's an establishment pick.
President Trump has picked Judge Brett Kavanaugh as his second nominee to the Supreme Court.
Brett Kavanaugh has checked virtually every box in the conservative legal establishment.
Trump may have campaigned as an outsider, but Kavanaugh is a creature of Washington with deep political roots in Republican politics.
Name something happened in the 90s, 2000s, he was involved.
And the Senate now has the chance to protect this glorious heritage by sending Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
Since being nominated by President Trump for the Supreme Court, Judge Brett Kavanaugh has been making the rounds to win support in Congress. With his very likely confirmation, the Supreme Court is expected to move farther right. How might that impact access by civil rights advocates to the federal court system? We're going to discuss all that with Susan Fritchie, senior staff attorney at the Women's Law Project. Welcome, Susan.
Hello.
Also in studio is WESA's legal analyst and host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast, David Harris. Welcome back, David.
Kevin, good to be with you.
Your comments and questions, as always, are welcome. You can email confluence@wesa.fm. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. First, I want to start off with both of you. What are some of the key issues in your mind that might likely come before the High Court in the next session that Judge Kavanaugh might play an important role in deciding? We'll start with you, Susan.
Abortion. Abortion rights, reproductive rights, women's rights. The future of Roe versus Wade is squarely on the line, and it is not looking good.
Okay, so that is percolating up the system through the judicial system?
Oh, absolutely. There's any number of abortion cases in the lower federal courts that will sooner or later, perhaps within a year, perhaps within a year and a half, make their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And with one more vote on the side of Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, we may see the end of legal abortion in many states.
Kevin, I would look for three things from Judge Kavanaugh in the new Supreme Court when it starts its new term, assuming he's there. Number one, any cases involving regulatory changes, and these things regularly came to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where Judge Kavanaugh has sat for more than 10 years, and he was a very conservative voice on regulatory matters. Number two, privacy. I think we're going to get an increasing number of privacy cases, especially digital privacy cases. We have several in the pipeline that are working their way up towards the Supreme Court, and Judge Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit had at least one big chance to show where he stood on those things, and he stands squarely in the camp of allowing government to have power in the surveillance area.
All right. So let's touch upon some of those in more detail. Let's start with Roe v. Wade. President Trump had promised all along to overturn it. I believe there's an Ohio case that's making – might that be the case that gets things to possibly change the 45-year-old landmark ruling?
There are numerous cases out there. There are cases involving reason bans. There are gestational limit cases. There are trap law cases. There is a whole cornucopia of cases to choose from, and it's hard to imagine that one of them will not soon make it to the high court. And, I think people are waking up to how much danger we are in. The Center for Reproductive Rights is predicting that if Roe were to fall, 22 states would ban abortion outright. 8 states, including Pennsylvania, are a toss-up. And in 21 states, those would be the free states. Those would be secure.
Yes, I think Sue is right. And I wouldn't be surprised that somewhere between 1 and 5 years, we have one state come forward with a very conservative legislature, maybe a Louisiana, Mississippi, and Oklahoma, pass a bill that outlaws abortion. And it would be a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. That would be the moment. And then after that, should the newly constituted Supreme Court uphold that, then it would be a state-by-state fight, and you have exactly the kind of patchwork system that Sue is pointing out.
So you mentioned Pennsylvania as a toss-up state. Refresh our memories. Was the last major ruling regarding abortion Pennsylvania's abortion control law?
No, it actually arose out of Texas, and it dealt a system of clinic regulation.
That's right, whole women's health.
A very similar system is in effect here in Pennsylvania now. And whole women's health was a glimmer of hope in an otherwise pretty bleak landscape because it did put some limits on the government's power to regulate abortion out of existence. It held that when a government imposes a health regulation on the provision of abortion care, it actually has to benefit women's health. And if the burden of it outweighs that benefit, it's unconstitutional. That is now on the chopping block. And we have seen state after state after state lose their abortion service network so that now there's a number of states where there's one provider. Pennsylvania has 17 at this point. But we could be down to simply no providers.
How important do you think this the abortion rights issue, do you think it's going to is now being elevated in the gubernatorial contest? Because you mentioned a toss-up state. Right now, Governor Wolf, he's reelected. He'll veto any such thing. He has said so. But so do you expect the issue to rise in importance in the gubernatorial election?
I don't think there's any doubt, because if not in this gubernatorial election, the next one in the next state, because what will happen as these restrictions kick in and as the court validates them, as both Sue and I seem to expect, it will become a political issue state by state. And that will mean, in effect, that people in certain states will have access, those without states that protect the right by legislation will not. And so all elections at the statewide level will have this as a feature issue in some form going forward.
Are we right to assume what Judge Kavanaugh, if he's confirmed, and it seems very likely the Republicans have the votes the Senate to do so. But are we assuming too much when it comes to abortion rights and Judge Kavanaugh? Because I believe it was during his nomination hearing for D.C. Circuit Court in 2006, Senator Chuck Schumer pressed him on abortion rights issue. And, quote, he said, Judge Kavanaugh, if confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Court, I would follow Roe v. Wade faithfully and fully. That would be binding precedent of the court. It has been decided by the Supreme Court. Does that say anything about what he would do, or he just was following somebody up above him?
That's the point. I mean, you just said it. He's following binding precedent. Once you're on the Supreme Court, you're supreme, you know, and you get to do what you want to do. And there is no backstop like that anymore. So I don't think that statement of his is probative in any way of what he'd do on the court, whereas his teachings, his writings, and his dissents in other cases are.
Yeah, I agree with that. And we've seen that pattern over and over and over. You know, the term activist tends to be associated with liberal activist. But what we have had for at least 10 years is a very activist conservative majority in many instances on the Supreme Court. Think of Citizens United. That was all settled law for years and years and years. Think of the Voting Rights Act. That was settled for years and years and years. And you had a conservative majority come along and say, well, sorry, doesn't work anymore. Goodbye. So when you have precedent, it's binding. But when you're the highest authority, you can unbind it. That's the whole thing of being, as Susan says, supreme.
Well, let's continue with that idea of precedence. How does it really come into play in the next Supreme Court when we have a new ninth member? What are some of the potential issues that could, I don't know, get overturned? I mean, let's face it, conservatives have often said they want their justices to follow the Constitution, not make law. But are they making law by changing law?
Well, here's kind of one of the nightmare scenarios we've been talking about around my office, which is, did you know that Pennsylvania passed a law back in 1989 to force women who are married to get their to notify their husbands if they want an abortion?
Yes.
And that law has never been in effect because we sued and we won, and there's an injunction in place. Now, what happens down the road if the basis for that injunction is vacated, is no longer there? That law horrified and offended women in Pennsylvania tremendously. And yet without Roe and without the Casey decision that struck it down, could we be looking at husband notification provisions in the future?
It's a good point. And, you know, when we talk about Roe, two important things to remember. Roe is connected to other similarly based rights, such as the right to access contraception.
So we're talking healthcare here.
Yeah, healthcare overall and contraception in particular. The other thing to remember is that just because Roe may be overturned does not mean there won't be abortion. In states where there's no abortion clinics, there will still be abortion. It just won't be safe or legal. And then if you have the money and the access in other places, you'll be able to get it. So it will change the picture. It will not change the need.
I want to ask you about, in our remaining time, about the potential impact of on other issues that advocates might want to press for in the court system to make gains that they support, whether it's equal pay for women or something else. Might there be concern that some of the gains that have already been made could be removed, reversed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're worried about pregnancy discrimination cases. We're worried about employment discrimination, about Title IX sexual harassment cases. We're worried about gender equity in athletics. We're worried about LGBT rights. I mean, we're really worried about that. The cases like Roe and Casey provided the underpinning for those rulings. And if you start picking apart those rulings and you pull out the Roe and Casey thread, at what point does that whole fabric unravel?
I'll give you one from the other side, Kevin.
Okay.
We have since 2009, the Heller case said in an opinion by Justice Scalia that states cannot essentially outlaw possession of guns for self-defense. And many cases have been brought up toward the Supreme Court in the time since, trying to broaden the Second Amendment rights to make them even more protective of gun ownership, even though Justice Scalia famously said there can be gun regulation of all kinds. You just can't have an outright ban. I would expect from the other side of that debate, people who want greater gun rights, they're going to begin pushing these cases up to the Supreme Court. And I think there is some indication in Judge Kavanaugh's record he will be more favorable to those, more open to those challenges than Justice Kennedy was.
Okay, we have just a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you, so what does this do, whether it's fear of accessing the court system because you might fear that you'll actually lose what you've already gained. So what's the recourse for groups that are advocating for other changes that will benefit the people that they serve, that they represent?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. We have to look really long and hard before we take cases to a federal court system that ends in a hostile Supreme Court. So we look at the state court system, we look at the legislative branches, we look at local government, we look at trying to empower state and local governments to protect people's rights.
I think that's a great point. There will be hesitation, I think, from people who want to expand or get protection from rights that have traditionally enjoyed federal protection. It's not going to be so easy now. Federal courts have always been the last guarantor, and we won't see that quite as much. And I particularly fear for that in the voting rights area. They're going to have to go back to the legislatures. They're going to have to go back to electing people who will represent them on the state level and do the things that advocates want. There just won't be an alternative in the federal court system.
1 minute left. So are the state courts, the state legislators, the governor, especially here in Pennsylvania, are they up to that task, though?
The people better rise up. That's all I can say. I mean, it's an incredibly critical moment in our history.
They're capable of it, Kevin. They're certainly capable of it, but it's a question of who gets elected. I mean, elections have consequences. We're seeing it now with the appointment of Kavanaugh, and we will see it in future years as we try to make some of these things work on the state level that maybe don't work at the federal level anymore.
Literally 30 seconds. In the confirmation process, what are you looking to hear from Judge Kavanaugh?
I want to hear an answer to the question about what he thinks about abortion rights, about contraceptive rights, about due process privacy rights, and a straight answer.
10 seconds, David.
My expectations are so low, they're underneath the floor. There will be no answers. It will all be a kabuki dance.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst and host of the Criminal Injustice podcast, also a University of Pittsburgh law professor. Susan Fritchie is senior staff attorney at the Women's Law Project. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When thousands of teachers gathered in Pittsburgh last weekend for a national convention, much of the talk was about the recent Supreme Court ruling in the Janus case. The justices ruled that unions could no longer require school and government workers who don't join a union to pay, quote, fair share fees in lieu of dues. This could have a huge impact on public sector unions in Pennsylvania. That's the focus of a major report this week by The Caucus, the print-only newspaper focusing on government and politics. And we're happy to have with us on the line from Harrisburg, Brad Bumstead, who is the Harrisburg Bureau Chief for The Caucus. Brad, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
So, Brad, the gist of the argument is that some public sector workers do not like their unions making campaign contributions. How big is the public sector workforce in Pennsylvania?
Oh, I think the figure that's used is about 300,000 overall, but in state government, it represents about 80% of the workforce.
No surprise, your reporting showed that the largest recipients of campaign contributions from the unions are Democrats, right? I think you said Governor Wolf was the highest recipient.
Yeah, and no surprise there, and that's a traditional alliance. Between some in the Democratic Party, certainly not all, and the unions, and that was reflected in the contributions that we saw. But contributions are one of the things that could be affected by this. Membership could be reduced, not only by the people that pay a fair share not paying it anymore, but others in the union saying, hey, wait a minute, I get the same benefits, I don't have to pay anything either, and deciding to not be a member anymore. The unions are really worried that could wind up dwindling their numbers and the workforce. So that would impact their ability to make contributions and their ultimate influence in Harrisburg.
Is it a matter of influence, these campaign contributions? Is it strictly that?
No, it's not strictly that, but it's the number of members you have and the voice you have up here in Harrisburg is not just campaign money, but there's force in numbers. There's no question about it. And it's very hard if you become a second-tier union, you don't represent a whole bunch of people in the workforce, to have people take you as seriously and listen to your arguments.
Brad, for your report, you spoke with a labor professor from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. the co-author of the study on public sector unionship. So what did Robert Bruno tell you about his findings?
Well, that he expects the impact from this decision to take place within 3 to 5 years from now, that it's going to, you know, be a gradual effect. And the co-author of his study on that, Frank Manzo, predicts a 4 to 5% shrinking in, he said, 10 years. You know, so that's talking about the workforce going down from 248,000 union workers to about 210,000. Bruno was simply telling me that he believes it's going to occur a lot more quickly than that. I would say I've heard that PSEA has made long-term plans to deal with this going back, you know, 2 years even. The unions have been anticipating that this could happen. No one was shocked by it. They fully expected this to happen. It would have been a real surprise if this had been shot down.
PSEA, of course, the largest teachers union in the state.
Yeah, anyway, that's where it stands, and they're braced for this. And, you know, if the shrinkage is 5%, I don't think it's going to mean the sudden end of union representation in Pennsylvania. It's not that large, but gradually over time, it will take a toll.
You were mentioning the gradual impact, but could there be eventually a direct impact on the workers? The unions don't have as much from dues and fees. They might become weaker. They have less leverage in contract negotiations, and maybe therefore an impact on the pay the workers actually receive.
Yes, that's what some predict with that, and it certainly wouldn't result in a loss of any hourly wage now while they're under contract. But as you point out, if you have less bargaining power when the next contract is decided, and that could certainly foreseeable, then maybe you don't get the improvement in health care benefits you were seeking, or maybe you make less money, or there are fewer of you to do the job. Has to be a concern.
Are the unions doing anything to mitigate the impact?
They may. I'm sure that, there could be another court challenge at some point to try to whittle away at this, but you got to be careful there, because if Trump gets his nominee to the court and the court becomes even more conservative, the ruling could even be more brutal on unions. One thing that is that this is a Supreme Court decision. It's the law of the land. However, it has to be implemented in each state, you know, to show that there's, cause to apply that here. And there's currently a Pennsylvania case or two that's pending that could result in implementation of Janus.
Brad Bumstead is the Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Caucus, the print-only newspaper covering government and politics. Brad, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, is nature turning us? There's an increase in ticks and invasive species in Pennsylvania. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Kennywood's replacement for the Logjammer ride has remained a secret until this week. Thursday, the park announced it would build a record-breaking Steelers-themed roller coaster called the Steel Curtain. And pit researchers proved what we kind of already knew to be true: alcohol makes people more attractive. In other words, beer goggles are real. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ticks, rabies, invasive species, not quite the biblical plagues, but they're still having a negative impact on Pennsylvanians, our furry friends, our vegetation. We're going to talk about these pesky invaders, foreign and domestic, as well as their devastating effects on our trees with John Hayes, outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back, John.
Morning.
And on the phone from Philadelphia's reporter Susan Phillips from State Impact Pennsylvania. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Kevin.
Your comments and questions are invited. Email confluence@wesa.fm. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. I want to get to the more statewide problems in a minute or so, but first, rabies. John, earlier this month, The health department reported the 9th confirmed case of rabies in a wild animal in Allegheny County. In this case, it was a groundhog. To round out the score, it's 4 raccoons, 4 bats, and a groundhog to this point. You're the outdoors guy. Are outdoors enthusiasts concerned at all about rabies?
I don't think any more than usual. The good news is rabies is down a bit from previous years. And the better news is that 3 or 4 people a year, humans, get rabies across the country. So, you know.
And it's been years since one's gotten it in Pennsylvania.
1984, I think. Yeah. So it's you're probably not going to get rabies.
Is that one of those words that sort of alarms us?
I think so. Maybe we watch too many werewolf movies. I don't know.
Now, a major concern we know for eastern Pennsylvania, Susan, is a particular invasive species, the spotted lanternfly. Susan, you did an extensive report on this creature. How did it get here? Where is it? What's it doing?
Well, they think it came here. They're pretty sure it came here through international trade in some form or another, whether that was, you know, airborne through an airplane or through a ship in a container. They first found it in Berks County in 2014. And, you know, the USDA documented that the infestation covered about 174 square miles in 2016. But by the end of 2017, it had spread to more than 3,000 square miles. So right now in Pennsylvania, there's a 13-county quarantine. And it's, you know, it has different life stages. It starts out sort of as this black crawling bug with white spots, and then it develops red spots, and then it eventually develops wings so it can fly. And the thing that makes it so pervasive is that it can lay its eggs everywhere. You know, it doesn't care where it lays its eggs. So it can lay its eggs on trucks, cars, toys, trees, and that's why they're so afraid, federal and state officials are so fearful that it's going to spread even further.
We talked with Shannon Powers from the State Department of Agriculture. I believe the Pennsylvania legislature has approved $3 million in its most recent budget to research and combat spotted lanternflies. Although officials have been able to contain, or at least try to that 13-county region that you've been talking about, Powers told us the government can't do it alone.
The government cannot pay to eliminate invasive species on everyone's property. Everybody needs to be able to recognize this is an invasive species. This has the potential to damage my business, to damage my livelihood, and on an individual level, just ruin products that I really enjoy or make them more expensive.
Susan, your reaction to what she said?
Well, yeah, and I think that's why they're spending so much money, not just on mitigation and elimination, but also a public awareness campaign. You know, right now it's primarily in areas of Berks County, Montgomery County, Northampton, and Lehigh counties. And I was out in Montgomery County with an arborist for the story I did, and he was out there in, you know, this very leafy, bucolic suburb, and we saw hundreds, if not thousands, of these little black bugs crawling up maple trees. And what happens is they don't just suck on the tree sap and sort of weaken the tree, but when it becomes a flying insect, it excretes this really gross bug poop, basically, that's like yellow and sticky. They call it honeydew. And that will cover the whole tree, or that will cover like the ground underneath the tree and maybe a deck that's like underneath the branches of a tree. And then what happens is, you know, this sooty mold, it's a great sort of petri dish or growing, you know, it's a great growth source for the black, what's called black sooty mold, which can cover the tree and hamper photosynthesis. So they're worried about the trees, they're worried about hardwoods, but they're really worried about the grape crop and other fruit trees and how it may impact not just the growth rates of these fruits, but also just how the grape is going to taste and that, of course, could impact the wine industry.
Well, speaking of that, a lot of there's wine industry in the northwestern part of Pennsylvania, John.
There is. They're really worried about it there. In all, there's a lot of fruit industry in Pennsylvania, $178 million in fruit industry, but the $12 billion hardwood industry is really threatened by lanternflies. I know that there's about $500,000 in research studies going on at Penn State right now, maybe another 40,000 in Temple University, but they this is one invasive that they really need, that the state feels they really need to get a handle on.
Okay. I want to talk about an even smaller pest than that which Susan just described, the spotted lanternfly. John, that's the tick. You've been reporting on this. How bad is this tick season?
We've had a long, wet spring. So all the bugs are reproducing at a higher level. And, there's nothing that you should do this year that you shouldn't have done in past years. I see people walking around in the woods in flip-flops and short pants. And, it's hot and you want to cool down, and yet you're going to get bugs. You're going to get ticks. Boots, socks, long pants, long sleeves, and check yourself when you get in. There's not much else you can do. If you do get a tick bite and you remove the tick and you see that target-shaped rash around it, that's an early sign of Lyme disease, okay, which could be serious.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about the serious nature of a tick bite, what it could do. I mean, about a year and a half ago, my dog got Lyme disease from a tick bite, nearly died. I mean, this can be dangerous to our furry friends as well as humans.
Sure. I had a tick this spring. I camp at Assateague every year for Memorial Day weekend, and when there were standing pools of water everywhere, mosquitoes more than usual. I got a tick. I have a friend who has Lyme disease, flu symptoms, arthritis symptoms, yeah, all the time, and it can get worse. It's worth taking a little bit of precaution to just keep these ticks off you, particularly this year when there's probably more of them than there may have been in the past.
And I understand that the ticks hang out on the Japanese barberry, and that's become quite common around.
Well, we're talking about... they're called black-legged ticks. People call them deer ticks, but that's not actually accurate. The main vector is mice and small mammals. The thing about deer are larger, will carry more of them, and go farther distances. So, animals, your indoor-outdoor pet is very susceptible to ticks.
All right. Susan, I wanted to ask you about another insect. I mean, for years we've been concerned about the emerald ash borer. I mean, it destroyed thousands and thousands of trees in Pennsylvania. The officials you've talked to, are they more concerned about the spotted lanternfly than the emerald ash borer or not?
They are, and here's why. I mean, the emerald ash borer only eats ash trees. That's the only thing it cares about, and that's what it likes to munch on. When it comes to the spotted lanternfly, they'll eat anything. They are attracted to another invasive species called the tree of heaven, or some people would know about it as the ailanthus tree.
Ah, okay.
And that's another invasive species that came here 150 years ago. And so you'll see them. It's sort of a weed tree. You see them along, railroad tracks. You see them in empty lots in the cities. And the adult lanternfly, which is a very colorful, pretty insect. It's, it's got these red spots, and it's red and black spots. It seems to be attracted to actually the ailanthus tree. So one of the interesting research that's being done is, using these ailanthus trees as trap trees, going out there and sort of clearing a lot of the ailanthus trees and leaving a couple of standing, and, hoping that a lot of these adult lanternflies will be attracted to this ailanthus tree. And then when they get to the ailanthus tree, then, of course, they can kill them.
Right. John?
I think what's happening, Kevin, is humans are the main vector for bringing in these invasive species, plants or animals or aquatic invasive species. And the reason that they spread the way they do, of course, is there's no pathogens, there's no predators eating them, and they tend to they tend to work well with other invasive species that are also, you know, without any resistance in Pennsylvania. These trees, the barberry, you know, the ticks are on all the plants, but the spiny nature of the barberry, the deer don't eat it as much because there's spines on it. So the ticks remain there. And some of these other things, woolly algids on hemlock trees and things, it's hard to contain these invasives once they come into the state when there's nothing resisting them.
All right. Thank you. John Hayes is outdoor editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Susan Phillips is a reporter with State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks so much to both of you for your time.
Sure.
Thank you.
Coming up, the changed focus of Pittsburgh City Paper. We'll talk with its new editor. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the country's first emergency medical service is deployed in Pittsburgh's Hill District in 1968. Before the Freedom House paramedics were established, police without proper equipment or training would respond to medical emergencies. At first, the EMTs of Freedom House primarily served the residents of the Hill, but soon they were responding to the whole city, serving as a model for ambulance services. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for July 20th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 2 months since the corporate owners of Pittsburgh City Paper hired a new editor-in-chief, longtime Pittsburgh sports writer, commentator Rob Rossi. What's happened since then? What else is in store? Rob is here to catch us up. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Second appearance, I think.
Yes, exactly. Your questions, comments for Rob are invited. Email them to confluence@wesa.fm. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, Rob, many people know you as a reporter, a columnist, with an emphasis on our favorite team, the Penguins. Why did you want this job?
Well, I left the place I was at for about 17 years in February, the Trib. I had a really good run there. I kind of was burnt out on media. I've been doing this since I was 16. So I was looking into taking a bit of a break, and I got a call from the Butler Eagle. They wanted to take City Paper in a direction that we thought would be a little bit more, what's the right way to put it? I'll put it the way they put it. Get it back to being the City Paper and arts and entertainment. You know, I had never been the big boss. And so I thought, hey, this could be fun. I've always been a big fan of the City Paper. I've always thought if I had a chance to help a place like that, it would be, you know, sort of an obligation to somebody who's been fortunate enough to do almost everything he wanted to do from an individual standpoint. I couldn't see myself covering another Stanley Cup final or Super Bowl or playoff game without being bored to tears. So I thought this might be fun.
All right. So how do you see Pittsburgh City Paper fitting into the market's media landscape?
Well, we're a free alternative news weekly, which we've always been. You know, we have at times had, you know, upwards of 70,000 subscriptions, or excuse me, not subscriptions, readership.
Right.
And that number wasn't as high. It has been shrinking over the last several years. And, you know, when I looked at the reason that number went down, it really occurred to me that City Paper got away from being the cultural Arts and Entertainment Authority that it had been. And decisions had been made to cut some of the arts and entertainment content in favor of more news. And I don't think people ever picked up City Paper for just one thing, but if they did, it was to find out what was going on and a little bit more about what was going on. And so when I took the job, I thought, boy, if we could get back to that and maybe imagine a way we could do it digitally, in addition to on in print, we could really get City Paper back to being what made it in its most successful run. I think if you look at the height of City Paper, probably Chris Potter, who, you know, you guys know pretty well.
Yeah.
He was probably the standard of where it was. And I'd like to get it back to that where you do have news, and we do, but certainly more focus on the arts community and the entertainment community.
Will City Paper, under your leadership, cover politics?
Yes, we'll write news stories about politics.
All right. What about political opinion?
No. I don't like playing for ties. It's why I think I was successful as a beat reporter. The daily newspapers have the burden and the responsibility, because of their resources, of holding our elected officials accountable through opinion. We are a smaller staff. We are a staff that will devote resources when we can and when we feel it's necessary, Antoine Rose being an example.
Right.
We'll write insightful pieces, but we aren't going to be the place where you wag your finger repeatedly at a politician. I'd rather come at them with facts.
Well, let's face it. Your predecessor, he says he was fired. The ownership didn't say a reason. He said he was fired because he focused on a particular state lawmaker, Daryl Metcalf.
Right. Well, I'll just say this. The Butler Eagle had never pulled a column or news story written by anybody on the previous regime. They never censored or edited it. And the reporter who was writing 90% of the stories about Metcalf is still on our staff. In fact, Ryan Dito, who is that reporter, is somebody I promoted to senior writer because I'm a huge fan of his work, was before I came to City Paper. I view it as my job to help him get more of an audience for his work. We have covered politics since. What people want to do to promote their own interest is their own decision. You know, we welcome competition from anybody that wants to do it. We know what we do. We know who we are. And we think it's a better marketplace when there's a lot of different people trying to do things. But we know that we don't have to try to do it. We know we can do it well.
We have just about 2.5 minutes left. I got lots of questions to fire at you. I didn't do a count, but it seems like there's an increase in first-person accounts. Is that going to continue, and why so?
I want City Paper to read more like a magazine. I want my writers to have freedoms that they don't have at some of the newspapers I've been. I don't want my writers to think that they are always part of the story, but I don't want them to be inhibited as storytellers by forcing themselves out of it.
How does that mesh with, quote, the standard of practices of journalism in, you know, part of the story?
I don't ever think journalists haven't been part of the story. I think that's a facade that people that run journalism companies have tried to hide behind for years. The truth is, I've always said this, anybody that knows me will tell you this, we try to be fair. We always strive to be factful, truthful. The idea that you can be objective as a journalist sort of eliminates the human part of it. And I have yet to meet the robot journalist that does a good job.
Now, real quickly, have you gotten any reaction? Have the changes been in place long enough to get any reaction from readers?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard from several readers who have said, thanks for getting back to our roots. You know, the readers I hear from are sending me emails and leaving voice messages. I don't pay attention to the noise on Twitter. I never have. I've had a lot bigger Twitter storms than what people think is going on now.
In just about 30 seconds or so, your predecessor, Charlie Deach, who has started a new print venture, Pittsburgh Current, told us last week.
Did they print yet?
They have one issue.
Okay.
Yes. Said he doesn't believe there's enough advertising revenue for two alt newspapers in this market. Can two alt papers survive?
I don't know if the paper that Charlie's trying to start can survive. I know that City Paper has been coming out every Wednesday since 1991, and we're going to be doing that for well beyond the next couple of years.
Rob Rossi is the editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Rob, thanks so much for stopping
by. Thank you.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. In September 2016, WESA created a weekly news discussion program to explore in-depth stories and issues critical to the community. Over the last nearly 2 years, we've tried to bring the news together each Friday on the Confluence, and today marks the final weekly show. WESA General Manager John Sutton joins us in studio with details. John, so what's next for producer Megan Harris and myself?
Well, it's all good news. The Confluence is going to expand to a daily show. It's going to be on weekdays, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. We're also going to expand the scope of the content for the program as well. Going to do the news roundup still. We're going to include more original reporting from the WESA newsroom in the show. We're going to want to bring in more voices, wider range of topics from current events, health, science, tech, business, arts, food. You get the idea. It's going to be a little bit broader than just focusing on the week's news because we have every day to work with.
All right. So we're going to have the same in-depth discussions, be they interviews or journalists or policymakers or advocates discussion, plus a few more longer conversations, including those interviews I alluded to.
Yeah, so more voices, civic leaders, but also folks who are doing important things locally. Right now, the Confluence focuses on the weekly news. We want to focus on things that are happening that might not be in the headlines, but are still important for WESA listeners, for Pittsburghers to hear about. This is also going to be making time for interesting people who might be passing through town, speakers, authors, thought leaders.
Mm-hmm. So some of these names, I'm sure a lot of these names we'll be familiar with, but others maybe not so, but still very interesting to bring their thoughts.
Well, that is our goal. Our goal is to actually have it be a place where we create space to explore what's happening in Pittsburgh beyond the news, things that might be months away from being in the news, or issues that don't seem large enough to be in the news but are still important to all of us.
Okay, so how does this affect the rest of the programming schedule here on 90.5?
Right. So right now, morning edition is 5 hours a day, right, from 5 to 10. And most of the 9 a.m. hour has stories that aired earlier. And those repeats are going to go away. The first time we air Marketplace Tech Report with Molly Wood is in the 9 o'clock hour. We're going to keep doing that during the Confluence. And then the Takeaway runs Monday through Thursday at noon. We're going to just run that Monday through Friday. There's a weekend version of the Confluence that will go away, be replaced by Living on Earth, the environmental program. And then we'll also not be repeating the Confluence in the evening. We've had a lot of folks ask if we could play Fresh Air again there, which we had done in the past. So Fresh Air will be coming back in the evening as well.
John, how do you see this new Confluence? And you detailed some of the specifics of what will be in the show. How do you see that fitting into the overall mission of WESA?
Well, our job is to bring NPR quality reporting. As far as the newsroom is concerned, our job is to bring NPR quality reporting to stories about Pittsburgh and the region and the state. But our job is also to make sure that more voices are heard. And we've said this a couple of times, but what we want to do is to become a place where ideas about Pittsburgh come together, where people from diverse backgrounds in Pittsburgh come together. So the Confluence is not just about the news anymore. It's about the region. We think that's so important, especially right now with the way the news is unfolding.
Less than a minute left, John. So 5 days a week, 9 to 10 a.m. Speaking of Morning Edition, the new team will also include our current Morning Edition producer, Kylie Kaczynski. How can we get the audience involved here in sort of participating in the interview discussion process?
First, listen. And then second, we're going to be, if you've heard on 1A, we're going to be inviting people to send in ideas for content and also questions that we'll be asking folks. And so there will be a very interactive component.
And we're very much looking forward to that.
We're looking forward to hearing your work daily.
All righty.
You did a great job with this show. Thank you.
Thank you, John. John Sutton is WESA's general manager. And that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for our program is Tom Hurley. Production assistance from Kylie Kaczynski and Avery Keatley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Confluence returns as a daily program Monday, August 27th. Until then, good news to you.